Welcome to Getting Unstuck, Shift for Impact, with your hosts, Kirsten Rickert, CEO of Rickert Innovation Consulting, and Jeff Eichler, Director of Quetico Career and Leadership Coaching. When Kirsten works with organizations on their strategic planning and innovation efforts, and when Jeff coaches individuals and executives around career and leadership development, their focus is on helping their clients to think differently about change, not as something to fear, not as something they constantly have to react to, but as something they can initiate for their own productive purposes. We'll hear from change leaders from a broad array of fields. They will provide the inspiration, tools, and techniques to help us move beyond the external and internal obstacles that stand in the way of shifting towards something new, something better, something impactful. Getting Unstuck, Shift for Impact.
Hi, this is Jeff Eichler. Welcome to a special edition of Getting Unstuck. It's special for a couple of reasons. One, we finally got the chance to interview a longtime friend and colleague, Amnon Liebab, the Chief Innovation Officer of SIT, or Systematic Inventive Thinking. They're a global innovation consulting firm. Pearson and I collaborated extensively with SIT when we were working for Pearson Education many years ago. The second reason it's special is we've broken this interview into two parts. As you might guess, the subject is innovation, and because we're introducing what will be some very novel and counterintuitive concepts, we thought the interview was best broken into two parts because you will undoubtedly want to stop the recording and think about how these concepts, especially how the process and tools apply to your work. Before you listen, you might want to check out the companion blog page for this episode at quetico.com/blog. There I provide listener notes and follow-ups, as well as a schematic of the SIT innovation process. I've included a challenge question there, which Amnon references in the interview. Would love to hear your ideas on that. Here now is part one of our interview with Amnon Liebab.
And one of those helping others on the journey of change is Amnon Liebab. He is the co-founder and chief innovation officer of Systematic Inventive Thinking, or SIT. SIT is a Tel Aviv-based global innovation firm. Welcome, Amnon, to Getting Unstuck.
Hi.
I've had the pleasure of knowing you and working with you. I was doing a little research. We've known each other for 15 years.
Sure.
It was actually a Harvard Business Review article that I read that you had co-authored with three other gentlemen. And it was Finding Your Innovation Sweet Spot. And at the time, I was leading an innovation effort at Pearson Publishing, and we were investigating a lot of innovation firms. We wanted to partner with a known innovation firm rather than starting off on our own. And when I read your article, it was like a light went on for me. I just loved the fact that it was a and maybe it's my personality. I love the fact that it was a very defined process. It wasn't this kind of at random brainstorming. There are actually steps that you go through in your innovation process. And I love the fact, too, that it's not innovating out of thin air. You're actually starting with an existing product, service, or process. And which in our business at the time was very important because we were in educational publishing and educators tend to be fairly conservative. They don't want to do things that are truly out of the box. Mm-hmm. So we used to call it in the box innovating because they would tolerate a little bit of change. Mm-hmm. But before we get too much into that, tell me a little bit about yourself in this role. Let's say you do a lot of traveling. Let's say you've sat down with somebody on an airplane and you're making small talk and they say, well, Amnon, what do you do? Tell me what you do, but don't tell me your title or your role. What's the essence of you in that role?
Okay. So first of all, I do have a lot of questions of what do I do? And there's a kind of answer that I give when I want to the conversation to keep moving, and there's the type of answer that I give when I want. I prefer to end the conversation. I want to sleep in the flight or whatever. Right. But I give you kind of a short version. Sometimes I tell people that What I do is I help people invent stuff. That's kind of a very short, simplistic version. Sometimes I say my job is to help people and organizations to think, rethink what they're doing and do stuff differently from the way they were doing it before. That's another way of describing it. And I think it kind of nails it, basically.
So I'm curious, when you say that to somebody, if you were sitting next to them on an airplane or you're sitting next to somebody at a conference that you just met and you said that, what's their typical reaction?
Some people say, so you're high tech. And I say, yeah, high tech. And although, of course, I just gave an interview in Israel where I explained Israel, everyone kind of bows to the gods of high tech and think the high tech people are so innovative and everyone else isn't. And I kind of explained that I haven't found high tech people to be more innovative than others. They're just dealing with kind of sexier and more income producing products. So you can be innovative in any realm. Sometimes people say, wow, that's really interesting. And I say, yes, I think I have the most interesting job in the world that I've ever heard of. And some people say, can you really help people? Aren't you just either very creative or not? And I said, well, you can't deny that there is a difference between people in terms of how innovative they naturally are. But 25 years of experience have taught me that you can very definitely impact how creative and innovative people are by training them, by working with them, et cetera.
That's why I loved the process, because I worked with a lot of people who would have responded that way. I'm not naturally creative, they might have said. But the beauty of the process is that it helps draw ideas out of you. Because you're actually manipulating the current situation. In our realm, it was textbooks or technology. So we weren't, as I said before, we weren't starting from scratch. We were looking at what we were already doing and try to change that. Mm. And that gave people a lot of comfort, the people who said that they weren't naturally innovative.
It's true. Although one of the many paradoxes of our work is that on one hand, you want to give people comfort, so there'll be, when people would say, no, I'm not great. For instance, I worked a lot with advertising agencies. So very often, and I work with an account manager or a planner, and they say, no, I'm not creative. You know, there's the creative department, I'm accounts. I said, what does that have to do with it? One of the big mistakes of the advertising industry is they took a slice of the business and they gave them the title creative, which is a double mistake. First, it makes them think they're better and they're creative and they don't need to learn anything because they're all so great. And second, it gives all the rest the license not to be creative.
Exactly.
Because it's supposedly. So, but anyway, that was a parenthesis within a parenthesis. But when people come and say, I'm not creative, you really want to give them the space and the confidence and the comfort of allowing themselves to be creative and innovate. But also, on the other hand, our role is to create discomfort, because if you're comfortable, you probably won't want to change.
Yeah, right.
So discomfort is the name of the game.
Exactly.
Once I gave a keynote speech in Australia quite a few years ago, and they also invited one of the brothers who founded IDEO, and he was on the stage there. He was also a keynote speaker, and I was very kind of the anonymous, I'm still anonymous, and he was a celebrity and he still is a celebrity. But I beg to differ, because he kept saying how much fun it is and fun and fun and fun. And I got up and said, I don't think innovation is about fun. Actually, it's nearly by definition about not fun, because if you really and truly want people to challenge the way they think, they can't really enjoy it. They can enjoy some aspects of it. But in general, it's painful.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned your title, Chief Information or Chief Innovation Officer.
Yeah.
I made a pitch to our CEO at Pearson, because I got so excited about the work we were doing, I wanted to focus on innovation full time. And I made a pitch to the CEO, and whom I know you've met. We actually sat down with her, and she said, no, I don't want you to do that. I want you to continue doing the work you're doing, because if you have that title, other people think they don't need to do it. So I thought that was actually smart wisdom on her part.
I think it was smart wisdom, but as very often in innovation-related topics, something is the truth, but it doesn't mean that the opposite is also not the truth. So I like to quote sometimes Niels Bohr, the Danish physicist, quantum physicist. They said that the opposite of a small truth is a lie, but the opposite of a big truth is another big truth. And in innovation, I find very often, because it's what she said is definitely true, and I remember her. I also remember that the first time I went to meet her, the first sentence she told me was that she hates consultants. That was funny. But it's true that if you mark one person as the innovation guy, it gives the others license to not be innovative, like I said in the ad agencies. On the other hand, if you don't assign some people the task to officially their day job is to deal with innovation, then it won't really happen in your organization, because everyone who does it as an additional task or additional job, then their day job always takes precedence. So what you find is that people highly motivated and smart and with a part-time kind of title of innovation, they keep postponing the innovation work because they're too busy with the work they're really being measured on. So I just had a workshop this morning with the management of a company here in New Jersey, and they asked me this question: should we give some people the title of innovation or shouldn't we? And I said, okay, there's a balance here. There's pros and cons, but what we find consistently throughout with organizations is that you need at least some people, depending on the size of the organization and how much work there is, but you need at least some people whose role is officially innovation. By the way, the reason I have the title of Chief Innovation Officer has nothing to do with that. It's just that after 21 years of being the CEO, when I realized that really I'm not a good CEO and I need to bring a good CEO on board, and I should stop being a CEO, but I do want to keep doing the professional work. So I just became another employee of the company. And then it felt kind of strange that I wouldn't have any title at all. So they said, what are you going to do? I said, well, let's make me the chief innovation officer, because what I like to do is innovation.
There you go. So that's a good segue. You know, the reason we asked you to be on today, and I'm speaking for Kirsten Rickert, my co-host, who you know very well.
Yes.
Kirsten and I were both coaches. We had been certified by SIT as innovation coaches at Pearson. And in the work that we do, which is helping individuals and organizations lead productive change, and what we mean by productive change is change that increases the likelihood of achieving the outcomes that you desire and the impact that you want to have. Mm-hmm. Innovation is a tool that can help people do that. And so that's obviously why we asked you here. Before we jump into that, just give me the skinny on how you wound up at SIT. What was your road in getting there?
Tortuous and serendipitous road. And actually, I wandered around doing all kinds of stuff. And my principal was not, I never had a picture or a vision, as they say today, of a future that I'm aiming at. My rule was do something interesting and that you enjoy and that you feel that it's good for you. Until you see something else that seems better for you and move on to the next. And so I studied in the university for a few years, and while I was there, I was also working as translator and editor and doing all kinds of work. I worked as a social worker for a while I worked in construction a little bit, but the social work was really important for me. And then at some point, I bumped into a high school teacher, ex-high school teacher, and she was publishing in management journal. Mm. So she asked me out of the blue, kind of, what do I think about the journal? She gave me a copy. I told her, I sat at night and read it. I had no experience in management, but I said to her that I think it's not really so good. So she said, why? Do you want to spend some time telling me why? So I spent several hours analyzing it and taking it apart, and I really thought it wasn't good. So I told her why, and then a few days later, she called me and said, would you want to be the editor? And since I had never done anything close to it, and I had absolutely no idea about management and no interest in business or anything, I spent the night thinking, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. And then I said, yes. And I became the editor of this management journal. And I was doing it for like 2 years. And then I found a couple of people in the university in Tel Aviv doing research on this Russian inventor, Genrich Altshuler, who invented a methodology called TRIZ, T-R-I-Z. And I said, wow, this is fascinating, and let's write an article for my readers. And he said, no, this is just for engineers, because Altshuler had designed the methodology specifically for engineering problems. So I said to them, I think this can be translated into language that can be interesting for any manager, not just an engineer. So I said, okay, let's try. We wrote one article and people really loved it, so we wrote another one. And then a guy who's an owner of an ad agency called me and said, listen, I read these articles, and I asked myself, if there's a method for inventing ideas, my people in the ad agency, they need to invent ideas every day. Could you do that for them as well? I said, well, why not? I think it could be. So we got talking, and then at some point he said to me, when you leave your job, maybe come over to the agency and help me translate this into real life agency work. And I had gotten tired of the magazine. I had been there for 2.5 years. So I got a job offer from an institute that works in the Israeli educational system, teaching teachers how to teach the kids to think. Mm. And so I took a part-time job in this institute, and the rest of the time I worked for the agency. People would ask me what to do. I would say, on Wednesdays and Thursdays, I teach children not to believe what I tell them on Mondays and Tuesdays. So I did kind of both. And then we started developing from the agency these ideas. And we said, well, we can use it for technology and we could use it for advertising. So the combination of technology and advertising is new products. So we started using it and so little by little it developed into a methodology and a company and all kinds of stuff.
Just an amazing story, because it underscores how you've always got to keep your eyes open and your mind open and your spirit open to what could develop. That's a great story. Mm. You went on to write the article, the Harvard Business Review article, yes, to co-author that. And I'll have that posted, or I'll have a link to that posted on my website when we launch this interview. Obviously, innovation remains hot. It seemingly you can't pick up a copy of Inc. or look through the Harvard Business Review or any of those publications without seeing something about innovation. And I'm curious, when companies approach you, what are they looking for? Have they heard about you, or how do they start the discussion?
Truth is, it varies very much, and things have changed dramatically since we started out on this journey. Because 25 years ago, I remember when I would meet a manager, and I would say, well, you know, what are you doing, innovation? What do you mean? So I say, well, we help companies think differently about things. And so we said, but okay, but what are you an expert in? Are you an expert in pharma? Are you an expert in electric and medical devices? What do you know? Are you an expert in food? And then the concept that you can be an expert on innovation independently of the content of subject matter was really very weird, and it was difficult for them to accept. But let's say once they bought into the concept that someone can be an expert in innovation and help them in innovation in general, then it was very easy for them to hire us because they had never heard of anyone else who does it, and there were very few in the world who were doing it. These days, it's the total opposite. Everyone's talking about innovation. Everyone understands that innovation is a discipline. Everyone has an opinion, even though very often not based on much, but an opinion about innovation. So it's a very easy sell to say, you know, I'm an expert in innovation, but it's very, very difficult that they will want to work with you specifically since there are so many experts on innovation. Mm. So thousands of people are experts on innovation. So some of them are just, you know, hot air and they read something or they experienced something and now they feel they're experts. But many of them really have a lot to offer in terms of innovation. So today, normally if a company comes to us, they're already searching and they're approaching three or four other agencies.
Like
and,
we did,
Yes, and by the way, what happened with you guys I thought was interesting, and I remember your role in it because you read the article.
Yeah.
And I remind you that the first thing you did was not contact us. The first thing you did was try it out yourself. And I remember my wife, she was then my girlfriend, when we published the Harvard Business Review article, she said to me, "You may be creative, but you're really stupid because you've just given away all the good stuff. So who's going to hire you?" And then you came along and you were exactly the example of someone who had read the article, said, "Wow, this makes a lot of sense. So let's try it." And you went on a first offsite without us and tried it out, which happens to many others. But what I admired was that you had the integrity when it didn't work, not to say, okay, we tried the method and it's a lousy method, but you said, we tried it, it didn't work, so maybe we should give a chance to those whose profession is to use it. And so you came to us. So I think sometimes people come to us because they read about it and it makes sense to them. I think we'll talk about it more later, but our method is really very different from all the other innovation methods. So for some people, it drives them away because they say, hey, this is weird. What are these people saying? It's contrary to everything that everyone else is saying. And some people say, you know, I just talked to someone this today, like 3 hours ago, and he says, you know, we're committed to a certain way of doing innovation, and we've been doing it for several years, and you guys are so different. So I said, well, let's do a pilot and just try out something different. And it actually makes sense that when you're dealing with innovation, you would want to, at least from time to time, to try out something that's really different from what you know. So some companies come to us because of that. And a lot is like everything else, like, you know, choosing your sneakers. It's word of mouth. Someone that you know and trust has used it and he recommends.
Right. I'm gonna add a little footnote here for our listeners. I'm sitting with Amnon in his hotel room in New York City. I was lucky enough to catch him coming into town. And periodically in the background, you may hear sirens. It's part of the wonderful ambiance of living and working in the city. So in terms of the SIT method, and there are lots of other companies out there that innovate, how do you differentiate yourself? Is it what I saw, which was that it was a very defined step-by-step process and that you had certain tools? Is that one way that people see a difference in?
In order not to make this too much of a sales pitch for ourselves, I'll say what I think is intellectually interesting about what differentiates us rather than from the business side. We are a few years after the Harvard Business Review article, and we published several additional articles, but we published a book, and the book is called Innovating Inside the Box.
Right.
So one of the major differences between us and others is we say, you know, everyone's talking about think out of the box, think out of the box. And we talk about innovate inside in the box. In the box. Actually, I remember you told us something nice once that I quote very often, and you say, yeah, we call it innovating inside the box, but you're allowed to peer out of the side of the box as well.
The royalties for that expression are wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, true. Millions and millions. So, yeah, we say, and again, I was just talking about it yesterday with a company that one of the things are that companies are usually doing some stuff, some of it awesome stuff, some of it just good, professionally well done stuff. So I resent and reject this thought that, like, if you're coming with innovation, you have to, it means you need to throw out all the old stuff. Mm. And, you know, like, the box is full of really good stuff that you've been doing, and it's full of knowledge and professional expertise. So there's a lot in the box, in everyone's box. But I think the trick is what's inside the box to learn how to look at it differently from different angles, do different things with it. And yes, of course, from time to time, you have to reach out and grab some stuff, some enabling technology or something, and bring it into the box. But I think the illusion that if you go out of the box, that's where the exciting things happen. Mm. I think it's a mistake. By the way, I allow myself here in this ambient of a conversation, and not something that you don't usually talk about, the philosophical aspects, that outside, out of the box, thinking out of the box has a lot to do with all this culture of always thinking that you need something that you don't have. It's part of, I talk about it with my daughters many times. The temptation to always think if you just had something that you don't have, things would be better. And you talk to people, why aren't you doing things? Ah, because I don't have budget, I don't have the technology, I don't have this, I don't have that. They look, in Google, you're allowed to work 20% of the time.
Right.
So everywhere else, things are better. So if you just went out of your box, you could do things. And I say, no. The reality is that, you know, the box is the box, and that's the given. And the beauty is to do what you can do with what there is.
With what there is. You know, there's a sexiness, I think, in some people's minds to say we're doing something out of the box.
Yes.
But my experience, and I'm going to ask you to describe the SIT process and methodology right after this. My experience was there was just as much excitement, if not more, working inside that box. Yes.
And also, some people think that if you do inside-the-box innovation, it's just a incremental innovation rather than what everyone likes to talk about, the disruptive.
The quantum leaps.
Yes. First of all, this the concept of disruptive, I'm a bit allergic to, but I think, first of all, that this distinction, as if there was a black and white, the realm of incremental and the kingdom of disruptive, I think it's a mistake. I think a lot of disruption is a combination of incremental innovation. I think there's studies and articles explaining, for example, now classic examples of disruption like the iPod or the iPhone, how they were actually the result of many, many incremental advances in technologies and insights and design elements. And yes, with a guy with a genius, I allow myself to say sometimes an asshole with a genius, Steve Jobs, who had the kind of this view of looking at all of these incremental things and putting them together beautiful. But innovation is much more about increments. And I don't think incremental is less than, and I think if you want your company to be really innovative, you should give we can talk about what the ingredients are, but it will play out with a lot of incremental innovation that hopefully and with luck will build up also into larger things and impact that you can point at and say that's disruption.
It's so interesting to have you talk about that, the incrementalism. When we first started playing with the idea of digital textbooks. We took the textbook and we made it, we digitized it. Yes. And our market responded, that's not it. Yes. You know, we have the textbook, we can read the textbook, you're not making use of of the digital environment. So they wanted more, but it wasn't a hugely more that satisfied them.
Yes.
Take us through, Amnon, what makes SIT special, and I'll say that I'm speaking for myself, mm-hmm. but if you could kind of walk us through function follows form,
the different tools
and how things work.
Sure. So first of all, you mentioned before that some things are incremental and others are further away, and some are too far away, etc. So one of the frameworks that helps us, we talk about, that was the name of our article that you mentioned before. We thought the sweet spot of innovation, the innovation sweet spot. And so we work a lot from the assumption or the observation that companies are normally doing whatever they're doing. And then there's some pressure, either internal or external, to do something new. And typically, they go a little bit outside of what they're doing, their comfort zone, but not very far. So we call this the near zone. And the near zone isn't enough, because it's not enough of a change. And customers and clients, they're invested in the current situation. So very often, if your change is too near with what they know, it's okay. It's not threatening for them. But on the other hand, there's not enough of a promise of a difference to make the, given the kind of the incentive to leap to the new,
right,
to novelty. So this we call too near. And too near is not interesting enough and probably won't move the dial. And then, so there's pressure, and then people start doing things like brainstorming, which we believe is really not an effective way of innovating. And they come up with all kinds of blue sky ideas and crazy ideas and stuff. But this stuff is too far. And it can be far in all kinds of respects. One is, it's too far because there is the enabling technology is missing. And sometimes it's too far because actually it works and everything, but the public or your users are not yet ripe to use it, so it's not the right time. And sometimes it's too far for legal reasons or whatever other reasons. So in between, you can imagine concentric circles. The one in the middle is what you're doing right now. The next one is the near kind of bagel. And the one after that is the far. And as we say, what you're aiming for is kind of the sweet bagel, a sweet spot or sweet bagel between these two rings. And that's stuff that's far enough to make it interesting and valuable and impactful, but near enough to make it viable and implementable. So in a way, you can say that our method is geared to go for this soft spot or soft bagel. And our tools, some of them are designed, in principle, they are designed to push you out, and others are designed to keep you in so it will be reasonable and viable. So, for example, you mentioned the principle of function follows form, which actually wasn't invented by us. We adopted it from a guy called Ronald Finke, who wrote a book, I think like 40 years ago, called Creative Cognition. By the way, an interesting guy who I think disappeared at some point in life. And the principle of function follows form, so it's standing on its head, the principle that's been dominant in culture from the beginning, from the Bauhaus movement in Germany in the 1920s. And they coined the phrase form follows function. And the logic of form follows function is very sound, and people follow it today. They say, if you want to design something, the form that you're going to design needs to follow the function that this object or house or whatever needs to supply. So it makes sense. If I want to, here in front of us, there's a tennis court. So I won't design the building for a tennis court like the building for a museum, because they have different functions. So the form has to follow the function. What Finke said he observed that actually there's a lot of power in switching this around and saying, if you start from a form, said he did some interesting experiments that if you give people a function, let's say design a tennis court, they're very often or most of the right. time they will design a form that is very similar to what they already know that is good for a tennis court. But if you tell the people, hey, look at this weird shape, what will it be good for? Then people get to be really inventive. So we very often do an exercise that I, you know, recommend to our listeners. And we say, okay, now invent something, whatever you want. You have all the freedom of the world, brainstorm, no limitations, invent something really cool. You have 3 minutes. Okay, nice. People supposedly can be really creative and innovative. You give them 3 minutes, they come up with all kinds of stuff that's not really impressive. Now you tell them, for example, you draw something on the whiteboard, some shape, or you give them some other type of constraint. For example, you tell people, now imagine that you're in a car and you need to design some apparatus, some mechanism to do fitness in a car while you're driving. So it's a very constrained task. Sounds much tougher than the first task where you had all the freedom in the world to invent whatever you want. And you give people 3 minutes. After 3 minutes, they come up with really amazing ideas that you say, wow, that was really creative. So then you look at it and you say, this is really strange. In principle, any idea you came up with in the second exercise, you could have in theory come up with in the first because you were allowed to do whatever you want. So why was the second exercise so much more productive than the first? And so we talk about the principle of constraints, and we say constraints enhance creativity. That's right. And that's exactly the opposite of what brainstorming tells you. Or supposedly, if you have no constraints, you will be super creative. But imagine when you just have no constraints, it's very easy to just download whatever is on your mind anyway. But when we do serious innovative work, what the last thing you want to know is what's in your mind anyway. So what happens with brainstorming very often, it feels very productive, especially if there's a culture where people are afraid to say what they think. And so brainstorming really energizes them and gives them the opportunity to download, offload lots of thoughts that they have in mind. But you look at the results, say, wow, people are being really creative. Then suddenly, lo and behold, the second time you do a brainstorming, there's a dramatic decrease in productivity. And the third time, there aren't any good ideas at all. And the reason is that there's nothing in brainstorming that leads you to create new ideas. There's just a lot that helps you kind of clean the closets and throw out all the stuff that was there. And at the beginning, that includes some valuable stuff, and then it doesn't. So going back to constraints, and we're saying, okay, if you put constraints, the right constraints, that's very conducive to innovation. And if we go back to the exercise, so I gave you the constraints, and I gave them to you in a function follows form way. Why? Because I gave you a function, a general function of fitness, but I told you, I constrained the form. So you had to think of a car and you had to think of what's going on in the car. And you had to work back from that to connect to the function. And what we do, let's say in our workshops and innovation workshops, we take the existing situation as the existing form. We manipulate it, or you manipulate it. And then that gives you a new kind of strange form. And then you work back from that and you say, if I have this strange form, what could I do with it? Given that I know my customers and I know my clients and I know what right. interesting. So maybe I'll give an example to make it less theoretical and kind of more concrete. Would you like
that? Yeah, so stay with the car. What do people come up with as ways to exercise?
They come up with really cool stuff, and I prefer to leave it to the listeners. I don't want to ruin the exercise for them.
Okay,
so
okay.
Let's see what they can come up with. But I'll give you another example. For example, I say to people, think of a bicycle. And I say, okay, if you had to list the components of a bicycle, what would you write? And then what's the first component that always comes up in any exercise, any time I ask this question?
The wheels.
The wheels. And I don't lead them to it, but it's just the most natural thing, because it's very difficult to imagine a bicycle without wheels.
Right.
That's the essence of a bike. So I say, you know, it's so difficult to imagine a bicycle without wheels. So let's do the exercise and imagine. And so I draw a bicycle with a wheel-less bike on the board. And I say, okay, now imagine you're a producer of bicycles, a manufacturer of bicycles 50 or 60 years ago. And some weird consultant told you, try to sell the bicycle without wheels. So give yourself a couple of seconds, everyone, and think, how would you sell a bicycle without wheels? So people have all kinds of ideas, and we can enlist a few of them. But then I'd say to them, great, great, good, good idea, good idea, good idea. And then say, but, you know, today there's a $1 billion industry that's bicycles without wheels. You know, there's the static bikes, the exercise bikes. So actually, if you think about it today, it's not even surprising to see a bicycle without wheels. But the reason I said, imagine you were there 50 or 60 years ago, because exercise bikes were invented in Finland about 60 years ago. And think how you would react if you were in this meeting where you would need to approve this idea of a bicycle without wheels. And how probable it is that you would have said, no, it won't work.
Who's going to buy a static bike?
So this is the power of function follows form. You would never think of a static bike without wheels 60 years ago. But if someone told you, hey, take a bicycle without wheels and let's see what it could be good for, maybe you would come up with a thought. Actually, in a rainy day, I could exercise without moving in my living room.
Right. And the thing that I want to underscore, the thing that really kind of hooked me, was that we were starting with something that already existed.
That's true.
We weren't out there in the ether working with brainstorming. We were working, if we were a bike company, we were working with what we already had that was inside our box.
That's true.
Right?
And there's a huge advantage in starting with something that you already have, because you, for example, you know a lot about it and you have it, and the probability that you'll be able to implement your ideas is much higher. But notice also, would you say that inventing the industry of exercise bikes when it didn't exist before, would you consider it an incremental innovation?
No.
I think it's a dramatic innovation.
Dramatic.
But the fact that you used an incremental technique to come up with it has nothing to do with how incremental or it's totally disruptive to invent the concept of a static exercise bike.
Right. So you mentioned a word which I want to dwell on for a minute, and we're actually going to close out this part of the interview. This interview is going to come to you, listeners, in two parts. The word that resonates with me here that Amnon used was manipulate. And when we come back in the second part, we're going to go through the tools that allow you to manipulate an existing situation. And then Amnon's going to lead us in a demo where we're actually going to do some innovating, some light innovating. All right. So I'm going to close it out here. We will welcome you back in the second portion of this. This is Getting Unstuck with Amnon Leviev and Jeff Eichler.
I love Amnon. I was so disappointed I wasn't able to join you guys, but so grateful that you were able to have that really rich conversation with him, because I loved it.
It was a lot of fun. He was very tired, as you may hear.
Because he was jet lagged.
He was jet lagged and he'd been working for 2 days straight, but he's always got great stuff to say. What resonated with you?
So you've known him for many years and so have I, but I know that the two of you connected very early on when SIT came to work with Pearson. I had actually never heard this origin story of SIT before.
Right.
And so to hear how it moved from a very technical thing that was done by engineers only, and Amnon said, hey, you know, this could be relevant to management, people who are managing corporations, and hey, let's try it out in this context, and let's try it out in that context, and let's simplify it, and then let's share it. That was so powerful. It really, in some ways, the development of SIT was very SIT, right?
Yeah.
Loved it. Loved it. And I also got a big chuckle out of the fact that he said he was a little bit allergic to disruption. Because as he said, innovation now is no longer even a buzzword because everybody thinks they're already doing it. And so all you have to do is throw out a couple of terms and disruption is the latest one that's the thing. And I just thought it was really funny to hear him talk about how incremental can be really powerful.
Yeah, exactly.
The other thing that it was a joy to hear him describe is the idea of inside the box as being a differentiator between the SIT method and other methodologies
right.
that are innovation centered. And the idea of sort of thinking outside the box is this idea of stretching out to get cool ideas from afar. And it works. Inside the box works for all the reasons that Amnon talked about. But one of the reasons why it appealed to me so much personally when I was first exposed to the methodology is because of the level of respect that it has for the people who are already doing the work.
Hmm.
A lot of times when people say, oh, we have to be more innovative, it is an implicit criticism of the people who are working there. Like, oh, they're back in the Stone Ages. They're locked into the old way. What this methodology does is unlock the insights that are already in your organization in a very powerful way, but the respect of expertise, the respect of understanding who the customer is, the respect of understanding how to build it then once you invent it is very much a part of this methodology, and that always really, really appealed to me.
Yeah, and on that theme, there's also a respect for what already exists. And he used the word constraints. You're innovating against what already exists. You're innovating in a very limited, closed world situation. And I always had trouble with brainstorming because it's so expansive, you know, but when you're using their methodology, to me, there's almost a comfort in it. You're starting with something, and so it doesn't feel pie in the sky to me. I really like the idea of the constraints because there's a respect for what's already there. It's and like you're saying, there's a respect for the people. When we innovated at Pearson with some of our products, these weren't bad products. We were using them to innovate against and make them better. So I found that very valuable.
Well, I am looking forward to hearing the next podcast and hearing more from Amnon.
Yeah, it'll be fun to go through the tools. So stay tuned.